how he's aggrieved, attacked, and deserves more support. That hardcore base of support, though, is only a portion of the party and only a smaller portion of the country. There are a lot of people who support or might support Trump, but who I think will reflect on all of these criminal charges against him, and also specifically what he did after the election and up to January 6th. And we'll see how it all plays out. I don't think it's preordained at all, but I'm hopeful that presenting these facts, reminding people of the horror of what happened, will help them arrive at good judgments.
I mean, it's not a insignificant number or percentage of people who are supporting Trump. In fact, the numbers keep going up. He is neck and neck with Biden if the two of them face off in 2024. BBC says an average of opinion polls from July 31st suggests he has a commanding lead of 37 points over his nearest rival, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. The story was headlined, "Why Trump's Poll lead went up after criminal indictments." So I'm wondering, Dennis Aftergut, if you could respond to that. And then also talk about the judge in this case, Tanya Chutkan. Very interesting, appointed by Obama, I think, in 2013. She has gone beyond what prosecutors asked for with some of the January 6th defendants in terms of sentencing. She also made a decision in a Trump case having to do with him not wanting to hand over documents ruled against him. The significance of Tanya Chutkan in Washington, D.C., presiding over this case, as opposed to Aileen Cannon in Florida, presiding over the other Jack Smith case, which is around the Mar-a-Lago documents and the cover-up there, who is a Trump appointee.
There's so much to unpack in that question.
Take your time.
With respect to Judge Chutkan, you referred to her decision against Trump earlier in November of 2021, in which she denied his request for executive privilege to bar the January 6th House committee from getting documents from the White House. She ruled for that House committee. And in doing so, this relates back to what I said earlier, she said, presidents are not kings. Presidents are not kings. This relates to what Robert said at the beginning, which is absolutely correct. Jack Smith and the Justice Department are defending the rule of law and the American Constitution. Political calculations are not their business. That said, three quick points on the politics. First, political boats can only take so much water. There's an accumulating effect. Second, unlike national security documents in the Mar-a-Lago case, Americans witnessed the insurrection on January 6th. They witnessed, as you referred to earlier, Amy, or Jack Smith did in his statement, the assault on Capitol Police defending our Constitution. That makes a huge difference. And last, you see over time the accumulating effect. You see that growing numbers of even Republicans have been dropping off of Trump's support. Even as you see that his support increasing among Republicans, as you said. And yesterday you saw former Vice President Mike Pence turn on Donald Trump and say, this is why he should not be returned to office. Previously, Pence said that he should not be indicted for taking bad legal advice. He seems to have changed his mind. This indictment has every prospect of peeling off some Republicans, not the hardcore, as Robert said. But certainly in the general election, clear-thinking, independent Americans who turn elections.
And Dennis, after that, I want to ask you, this indictment, did you find any new information in it that had not previously been revealed?
Yes, but the key elegance, as I said earlier, is in the way it's done, the charges that are presented, the exclusion of other defendants from this indictment. But yes, there are some pieces of new information. Just for example, Mark Meadows, Trump's former chief of staff, is in the middle of the fake election conspiracy as alleged in this indictment, but he's not charged. And that is telling us by negative inference that he's cooperating. We also learned, as Amy said, about the other co-conspirators. We didn't know exactly who they would be. They are likely to be charged later, including Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman. And we also learned, this is a small tidbit, but it's interesting, that Mike Pence took contemporaneous notes in January of his conversations with Donald Trump. Two things about that of significance. Number one, it strengthens the case, the evidence, because Jack Smith now has those notes. And number two, why does someone take contemporaneous notes? It tells us that in late January, the former vice president who had served loyally the president of the United States for 4 years did not trust him any further than he could throw him.
Rob Weissman, before we end, on this issue of Mike Pence, quite interesting that he might not even qualify to be in the debate, in the first Republican presidential debate, according to his poll numbers and the support he's getting. But he could be a key witness in this case, the rival of President Trump for the presidency in 2024. If you could talk about Lauro, the new lawyer, President Trump is paying out tens of millions of dollars, apparently, though he's not known for paying lawyers. And there's been a whole question of where he's getting this money from. Did he raise it falsely, asking for support for the whole movement, but now for legal fees, et cetera? If you can talk about Lauro's point, I mean, Trump wasn't charged with seditious conspiracy. He wasn't charged with insurrection. But Lauro talking about the attack on free speech.
Right. Again, this is an example of Trump and his minions using legitimate accusations against him and throwing them against his opponents. There's no attack on free speech here. Donald Trump has attacked people's free speech throughout his long career, including before he got into politics. The argument here is that, well, Trump was just saying stuff, and he's allowed under the First Amendment to say stuff, including things that aren't true. But of course, the allegation is not that he was just saying things. It's that he was leading a conspiracy to overthrow the results of the election. People are saying, for example, criminals use speech all the time. This is a stick-up. Give me the money. That's not protected free speech. Just because you speak doesn't mean you get protected protection from criminal prosecution if you're speaking as part of a criminal enterprise. The other thing that's clear, the Trump lawyers and Trump legal team are going to argue is that Trump did not act truly, that Trump truly believed that he won the election. And one thing that the indictment does very well is explain not just the objective fact that he lost the election, but that everyone around him, except for his co-conspirators, everyone with credibility, everyone with authority, everyone with knowledge, told him over and over again that he lost. Two attorneys general, the head of election security of the U.S. government, his vice president, his campaign pollsters, state election officials, all of whom supported him and wanted him to win, told him that he, in fact, lost. So his claim that he believed this was a victory is not a credible claim, and I think not going to be a strong defense in this case going forward. The claim about First Amendment protections, I think, is pretty laughable.
Well, Rob Weissman, I want to thank you for being with us, president of Public Citizen, one of the groups organizing nationwide Not Above the Law Trump Indictment rapid response rallies in support of accountability Thursday, the day of the arraignment. And Dennis Aftergut joining us from Sonoma, California, former federal prosecutor, currently of counsel to Lawyers Defending American Democracy. We'll link to your piece in Slate. Jack Smith's January 6th Trump indictment is a prosecutorial masterstroke. Coming up, the war in Ukraine, as Russia continues to attack grain ports in Ukraine while Kyiv escalates drone strikes in Moscow. Stay with us.
I'm not no crocodile like the one in Dublin Zoo, who lived in a cage the length and breadth of his body, with a window which people would look through, and throw coins on his back to taunt him though he couldn't move, even if he wanted to. I'm not no animal in the zoo. I'm not no whipping boy for you. You may not treat me like you do. I'm not no animal in the zoo. My skin is not a football for you. My head is not a football for you. My body's not a football for you. My womb is not a football for you. My is not a football for you. I'm not no animal in the zoo. This animal will jump up and eat you. I'm not no animal in the zoo. And I've every intention of leaping up and getting you. La 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 la.
Football by Sinead O'Connor. She passed away last week at the age of 56. To watch our web exclusive, as well as the interview we did on Democracy Now! On Sinead, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. This is Democracy Now! We turn to Ukraine, where Russian drone strikes on the Odessa region caused fires at a port near the border with NATO member Romania that damaged facilities that transport Ukraine's crucial grain exports. This comes after Russia left a deal 2 weeks ago that allowed Ukraine to export grain to world markets through the city of Odessa. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Russia had, quote, once again targeted ports, grain facilities and global food security. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin after the attack and said he'll continue efforts to reinstate the Black Sea grain deal and push for de-escalation. On Tuesday, the U.S. envoy to the United Nations said there were indications Russia may return to discussions about the grain deal. This comes after Russian missiles struck a residential high-rise in the Ukrainian city of Kryvyi Monday, the hometown of President Zelensky, killing at least six people, including a 10-year-old girl and her mother. Dozens more were injured in the attack. One resident said she raced to the scene of the blast after receiving a panicked call from a friend who lived nearby.
I only heard, help me, so we jumped into our car and drove here. What we saw was pure horror, committed by the Russian, I don't want to say the word here. They hit a residential building, and her block is just next to it, so everything in her apartment was ruined. She survived and is alive, thank God.
Elsewhere, officials in Ukraine's Russian-occupied Donetsk region say two people were killed and six others injured when Ukrainian artillery fire struck a civilian bus. In Moscow, Russia's defense ministry says Ukraine launched a fresh wave of drone attacks on Russia's capital, with one of the devices striking an office tower that had been hit in a previous attack Sunday. Meanwhile, Poland's accusing Russian ally Belarus of violating its airspace with military helicopters. Belarus denied the accusation, but Poland's defense ministry said Tuesday it's sending, quote, additional forces and resources, including combat helicopters, to its eastern border. Also Tuesday, Belarus President Alexander Lukashenko mockingly told Poland it should thank him for keeping in check Wagner mercenaries now stationed in Belarus after last month's failed mutiny in Russia. This all comes as Saudi Arabia is planning to host a peace summit this weekend. This is U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
Support this summit. We have long said that it is important that Ukraine be in the driver's seat when it comes to any potential diplomatic resolution to this war. It's important that countries that have not yet heard directly from Ukraine hear from Ukraine. So we are gratified that there will be countries that are attending this summit to talk directly with Ukraine. If your question was with respect to what other countries will be attending, I would defer to the governments of Saudi Arabia and Ukraine to answer that question. If the question is respect, I'm coming to you. If the question is with respect to what U.S. government officials will be attending, I can confirm that there will be U.S. government officials. Not ready to make announcements yet about who those will be, but as the week goes on, certainly you can expect that we will do so.
In a moment, we'll be joined by Rajan Menon, director of the Grand Strategy Program at Defense Priorities, a senior research scholar at Columbia University's Saltzman Institute of War and Peace Studies, the author of several books, including Conflict in Ukraine, The Unwinding of the Post-Cold War Order. He also just recently returned from Ukraine and has some very interesting pieces. Rajan, it's great to have you with us. If you can start off by talking about the so-called Ukrainian counteroffensive and the state of it as you just recently returned from Ukraine.
The primary focus of the Ukrainian counteroffensive is in the south, particularly two provinces, in Donetsk, the southwest part of it, and Zaporizhia, to some extent in Kherson. The Russians have had a great deal of time over the past several months to create layered fortifications, to seed the area with mines, and they're dug in. The real question is, how much headway can the Ukrainians make in the face of those barriers, plus extremely intense Russian artillery fire and air power? They have made some advances in a few areas on the southern front, but we're way too early in this process to know how successful the counteroffensive will be. People have already called it a failure, some have called it a success. I think we should be in a wait and watch mode.
Juan, we're just turning on your mic. Go ahead. Juan, we can't hear you. Oh, go ahead. Rajan, if you can talk about Saudi Arabia, what's coming up this weekend, who's included in this so-called peace talks?
Well, Russia is not included, so it's not formally a peace negotiation between Ukraine and Russia. I think this is one of several efforts made. The Chinese have made an effort. The African group made an effort recently. This is now a third effort to get some movement on the peace front. The difficulty is that neither side, neither Ukraine nor Russia, feels that it is losing the war. Each feels it can still win. And so I have no indication that the two sides have any convergence in terms of how they see a settlement working out. So I wouldn't be very hopeful about these processes. If I had to give you my best guess, it is that we are liable to see this war continue for several months, if not more than that.
Yeah, I wanted to go back. I know we were having some technical difficulties, but I wanted to ask you, in terms of the offensive, the at least in the U.S. media, there was quite a bit of expectation, one, that the offensive would have started much earlier than it did, but also that it would have been more successful by now. You're saying that that it's still too early to say, but isn't it already pretty evident that what the expectation was of NATO and the Ukrainian government have not been met?
Well, I don't know what the expectations of NATO were, but let's remember that we're a month into this. The Ukrainians are hobbled in many ways, primarily the lack of air power, probably insufficient artillery and ammunition. And so I think to expect them to go charging forward into layered Russian defenses and take on enormous artillery fire and lose a very large number of people was, I think, from the beginning, very foolish. I know everybody formed a very quick opinion that the counteroffensive has failed. I'm not saying that it's going to be a smashing success, but I think one thing this war has taught us is that many things have happened that people said would not happen, beginning with the invasion itself. So I think at the moment, what the Ukrainians have done is to make some headway in three areas along the southern front. But, and this has been missed in a lot of the press reporting, they have carried out systematic attacks on Russian logistical facilities, on command centers, on fuel and ammunition depots across the southern front, including very intensively in Ukraine. The goal seems to be, and I'm not saying that this will succeed, to make it much harder for Russia to supply the troops that are in the south, dug in the south. So I think for all this to play out, we need time. It is definitely true that the Ukrainians don't have all of what they need to pull off a smashing counteroffensive. But from the beginning, this has been an uphill battle for them because in every measure of military power, Russia far exceeds anything they have, even counting Western support.
And I wanted to ask you about the impact of the Western sanctions or the NATO sanctions on Russia, which are the most draconian ever against a nation. Last year, apparently, Russia, not only did its economy not decline, but it actually there was an increase in production and output in Russia. I'm wondering your sense of how long Russia can hold out against these sanctions.
I've been skeptical all along that sanctions would make any difference in terms of getting Mr. Putin to stop the war. We have a long history with sanctions, and we know that when a government decides to pursue a goal that for whatever reason it deems extremely important, sanctions are unlikely to work. I think the history of sanctions in recent years or historically suggests that they don't really move countries away from positions that they're determined to produce. All the indicators of the Russian economy bear out your point. There's certainly no evidence whatsoever of personal discontent that President Putin cannot handle. I was just looking at some public opinion polls. They show no significant diminution in Putin's standing at home. So I don't think he faces any kind of possibility of an insurrection or opposition to the war. That's for many reasons. Some people support him. Other people don't like the war but are too afraid to speak out. Yet a third group may not like the war but are going about their business and just getting on with their lives. But the long and short of it is that he doesn't face anything on the home front that should give him a great deal of worry.
If you can talk about the people you met with in Ukraine, you wrote a piece months ago talking about why talk of negotiations and, you know, discussion in the media, because this is certainly larger than Russia and Ukraine. Russia's military far more powerful than Ukraine, but so many Western nations are now involved with supporting Ukraine. All over the world, people are concerned about what's happening. But somehow this discussion of negotiations is seen as a pro-Russian conversation, as opposed to a concern about the global just perspective on can we afford this war, especially when it comes to threats of nuclear weapons used, Rishan?
Right. So there are two issues that make the war of wider consequence. So there may be more than two, but I'll speak to two. One is, of course, the one you mentioned, the prospect of nuclear escalation. It is certainly something that we have to be concerned about for obvious reasons. The problem with escalation is that it's very difficult to know what is in the mind of Vladimir Putin. So you and I, for example, could sit down and try step by step to figure out under what circumstances might he escalate? Would it be situations situation, one situation, two situation, three. But we have no way of knowing whether he's thinking that way. And even if we could get a fix on what he's thinking, down the road 6 months later, his calculations could change. So there's a problem of logical deduction and how far it can get us. There's also an information problem because we don't have access to anything that he's written about this in a confidential vein or what he's told people. So we're flying in the dark. That is not to minimize the danger of escalation. It's certainly a problem. The second one is the whole question of what happens to global food prices now that exports from the Black Sea and now increasingly from the Danube, which the Russians are attacking Ukrainian ports in the Danube. If food from Ukraine, which is a major supplier of several grains and sunflower oil, comes to an end. So there are wider consequences. But we have to come back to the narrow question here, unfortunately, of have the two sides shown any indication that they're willing to sign a peace agreement? Mr. Putin's position has been, yes, we can have a peace negotiation, but Ukraine has to essentially concede up front that it will forfeit the four provinces in which last fall Russia conducted a referendum and said they were formally annexed to the Soviet Union. Now, the Ukrainians are not going to accept a partition of their country. It is true that they're in an uphill battle, but in my visits to Ukraine, one thing that's become absolutely clear, and this goes to the point of the U.S. fighting to the last Ukrainian, I understand why people are saying that, but it's not as if the Ukrainians are fighting unwillingly. So if you wrap all this together, the pessimistic conclusion I have to give you is that we're not at the end of this war and it will continue. But all of the risks that you mentioned, especially the food risk and the escalation risk, are certainly very much going to be present.
And I wanted to ask you, you've taken three trips now to Ukraine, to the area still under Ukrainian government control. What's your sense of how the population is holding up there? And obviously, we don't know what's happened in those areas that have been annexed by Russia. We do know that about 2 million people in those areas fled to Russia, not to the West. So that I would assume that they had some sort of support for what the Russian government was doing, or at least felt safer going into Russia than they did going into Poland or other parts of Western Europe. So I'm wondering how you feel the Ukrainian people are holding up at this stage.
Right. Just on your last point, you know, I wouldn't necessarily conclude that those who went to Russia did it because of pro-Russian feelings. That could be possible. The other explanation is simply that was the easiest escape route for them. And there's some evidence that some people who were in Russia were taken there unwillingly. So that question is still very much murky. As to the mood, I've been now to the southern front lines and eastern front lines. I've traveled all over Ukraine, and I've been to Ukraine even before the war. Coming to the war itself, one of the consistent things that I found, because I've asked people this a number of times, has the economic privation, the refugees, internally displaced people, the destruction of the Ukrainian economy, and has the number of war dead led to the point where you think that although you cannot get ideal terms, it's time to wind down the war? I have not met a single person who's told me, yes, the pain has gotten to the point where we have to seek a way out. Now, the one thing that the Ukrainians have to bear in mind is if the war drags on into next year, and the United States, which is the main funder of the war, because the number two country, Germany, gives only about a tenth of what the United States gives, will the United States at some point conclude that it cannot continue supplying the war, and will there be pressure on Ukraine to come to terms? That is what the thing that I think could force the Ukrainians to the table, because without American support, they simply cannot continue the war.
Rajan Menon, we want to thank you for being with us. Director of the Grand Strategy Program at Defense Priorities. He recently returned from visiting Ukraine. His books include Conflict in Ukraine, The Unwinding of the Post-Cold War Order. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.